Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Season 3 of Dogs Unknown, Episode 1. Please note the name change, as we did do a name change in Season 2, and we are so excited to be back. We have lots of great episodes lined up. We have 13 already lined up for this first season, and we'll be launching these weekly on Monday. So now through the end of June, there'll be new episodes coming out. And this season, we're changing the format just a little bit because we really wanted to focus on looking at our experience sort of being in this industry and where we've learned and evolved our thinking or changed our mind on things. And when we talked about it, what we realized was that really when we went to conferences and got to listen to all these great speakers talk, we definitely learned lots of things, but it was really about being at a table in a group atmosphere talking about various issues and things that people were dealing with. And that sort of group conversation really feels like you can really get into the thick of things, really get to a lot of nuance. And so for these episodes lined up today, it will just be us two, but then we will be on the future episodes, we will have other guests. A lot of the guests are other trainers and behavior consultants across our 11 Instinct locations. We do have some others as well. So we're just really looking forward to having these group conversations, hopefully giving you some insight into how we talk about things, because I think a lot of times things can be presented like they're pretty simple. And there's lots of things that can be, but there's also a lot of things that are challenging and have a lot of nuance. So we're really excited to bring this format to you. So we really hope you like it, and definitely let us know how you feel about it as this season goes on. But today, our topic is a really exciting one because we are focusing on an area that I think is probably one of our most popular areas in our nature-driven nurture framework, or things that a lot of, I think, pet owners seem to resonate a lot with, which is conflict resolution styles. And this is a topic that really applies to everyone who shares their home with a dog. So whether you have a brand new puppy or a totally happy-go-lucky, loves everyone and everything dog, or a dog with fear, aggression, or anxiety issues, this is going to be relevant for you. So we're talking about conflict that arises in your relationship with your dog. And more specifically, we're talking about how you about how your dog and you approaches conflict and tries to resolve it. And it's important to note that conflict is normal and an unavoidable part of any relationship, including a relationship between you and your dog. And if you have a multi-dog household, the relationship between your two dogs, I would even say a dog and a cat as well. So you can definitely apply these concepts there. And conflict becomes a problem when the strategies used by an individual or individuals to try to resolve the problem are physically or emotionally harmful to the other party. So that's what we're going to be, you know, definitely talking about today. And within our nature-driven nurture framework, my apologies, we identify four main conflict resolution styles that dogs use to try to deal with conflict when it arises with humans or with other dogs. And a lot of times you'll hear things like fight, flight, freeze, or fawn. Like those are like, you hear those a lot, but we use different labels for these. That seems, I feel like, kind of captures the essence of these conflict resolution styles. It makes it a little bit more fun to work with. But we call them peacemakers, ostriches, warriors, and Tasmanian devils. And so understanding your dog's conflict resolution style and reflecting on your own is a huge piece of the puzzle when it comes to maintaining a peaceful household and to protecting the relationship between you and your dog or between the dogs in your household. So before we dive in and discuss each of these four styles and what that means in terms of how you interact with your dog, let's take a minute to define conflict and discuss its role in a healthy relationship.
Sounds good. Today's conversation, we're really focused on social conflict. And, you know, for our purposes, we're defining that as any perceived friction or misalignment, and perceived as the important word there, because it's all about perception. Any perceived friction or misalignment between the needs or the goals or desires of two individuals Some really simple examples, if it's helpful, are between dogs and humans might be things like your dog found a chicken bone on the ground and they really want to continue trying to chew and eat that, but you want to take it from them. There's conflict there. There's misalignment between needs and desires. Maybe your dog really doesn't want to be touched, but you want to pet them or you need to brush them right now. Maybe you're on a Zoom call and you're busy with work and your dog really wants attention and connection right now, but you can't give it. Those are some simple examples of conflict. And I think it's really important to just remember that, as Brian mentioned in the beginning, conflict doesn't have to be explosive. It doesn't have to be bad. It doesn't have to equal an all-out fight. There are degrees of conflict. And what we want to keep in mind when we're having this conversation today is that depending on the degree of the misalignment and goals, depending on the intensity of the individual's needs or feelings, and depending on the conflict history between the two individuals, the conflict could be super mild, almost unobservable to someone looking in from the outside, or it could be really severe. But I think, again, just reiterating that all conflict isn't bad. Conflict is normal. It's expected. It's a part of any relationship that you have with anyone, including your dog. It's just, as Brian mentioned, how we deal with that conflict or how our dogs deal with that conflict that determines whether it's detrimental to the relationship, you know, both in terms of the individual's emotional well-being or their physical well-being sometimes. So I think that leads us hopefully into setting us up to get into the meat of today's episode, which is all about helping you recognize and understand your dog's conflict resolution style and hopefully your own so that you can really work on tailoring your interactions at home to learn to resolve conflict that is normal in a way that actually can enhance your relationship with your dog instead of maybe damaging it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, and I do feel like it's such an important thing to talk through, just because like a lot of times I think we feel like when there's an issue, like with a dog, say a dog showing aggression over resources or those types of things, like sometimes, you know, we just want to think about, well, how do we quote unquote fix that? And it's sort of getting into like just looking at that problem. But what I like about sort of looking at conflict resolution styles as well is it enables, I think, owners to think about like also like what can they do in terms of like the relationship, like how does the relationship impact that behavior? And I think, again, like not labeling stuff as like, oh, it's bad that they're doing that. It's sort of like, this is how they're choosing to resolve the conflict. I think it's more so like what I'm trying to say, I'm not doing a very good job, but it's more so, like it's sometimes I think it's easy to remove the relationship from issues that we're actually seeing and working on. Mm-hmm. And I think like kind of going through this today, I feel like it gives people building blocks to understand what can they do in the relationship, help understand the relationship better, help understand their dog better. So it's less about like, oh, my dog's just being bad. They're being a warrior right now. And how do I need to respond to that? So that was, you know, and I think that sort of gets into what our conflict resolution styles actually are. So I guess we can jump in and define those next.
Yeah, that sounds great to me. So we can go through them individually. And I think one thing we just want to call out that has already been mentioned a couple of times is that, well, it may feel like it's the case sometimes, these individual styles, like none of them are inherently good or bad. They're all valid. They're all normal. The ideal approach and maybe what we might deem the most appropriate approach can depend on the situation, but they're all valid. And we and our dogs will probably all lean on one of them at some point or another in their lives. But so that being said, let's dive in and talk about them. So first up, we have Peacemaker.
All right. This is where we would play Cat Stevens' Peace Train song if we didn't want our YouTube video, or if we were worried about the YouTube video getting shut down for copyright. But that's sort of the anthem that we use for peacemakers.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we want to talk a little bit about peacemakers. This, truthfully, I think is what people default to thinking dogs should do to resolve conflict, especially with people. It's sort of this expectation that we have with dogs that they're going to use appeasement to to resolve conflicts. They're going to be loose and wiggly, and they're going to lick your hands and lick your face, and they're going to get low to the ground or flop over and do really sort of playful, friendly behaviors to diffuse the tension. That's what a peacemaker does. The very apt name. We've all seen dogs probably do this, but I do think it's interesting that this tends to be the expectation, even though it's not necessarily the strategy that most dogs use as a default.
Right.
Do you have anything to add, maybe Brian, about that, those peacemakers in terms of description that I didn't capture?
No, I think you're right. I think it's what most people, think that dogs do. And also I think what most people are hoping for. Peacemakers are definitely, especially when we run play groups and things at our facilities, peacemakers are really nice to have around a lot of times because because if things start to escalate, they do things to try to bring the temperature down. So they are quite gifted, I think, or skilled. I don't know what word we want to use. I don't know if it's, it's probably a combination of everything, but it is something where like there are dogs that are very highly skilled in that. And I know like over the years at Instinct, we've had certain dogs, certain helper dogs, or even certain client dogs that would help us that were absolutely amazing in situations where things could get, if the temperature was coming up a little bit in a play group, they're really nice to have around. But also, and we'll talk about nurturing dogs with peacemakers here in a little bit, but I think there's certain things to keep in mind because it's easy to just assume that they're okay.
It's easy to overlook the needs of a peacemaker dog in conflict situations because they're so good at navigating it.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, without escalating.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. So those are peacemakers. If anyone has one at home, consider yourself, I don't want to say consider yourself lucky, but a little bit consider yourself lucky because, again, they're pretty skilled at what they do. And especially sometimes well-suited to navigating more complex human or dog environments. So depending on your home, that can be a really nice thing to have. Next up is ostrich. And we think about the classic ostrich behavior of burying your head in the sand when there's something that arises that's maybe problematic or troublesome. Ostriches use avoidance to try to diffuse a threat, or at least to kind of draw attention away from themselves and avoid things escalating further. So a lot of this is all about how do we avoid further escalation of conflict one way or another. With peacemakers, they're using really friendly kind of social overtures to say, hey, let's be friends. There's no problem here. With ostriches, they're trying to just avoid altogether. Hey, I don't want any problems. Turning their head away, moving away, sometimes averting gaze. Sometimes these dogs might roll over and do what we call like tapping out, which some folks misinterpret as wanting a belly rub. But you'll see dogs roll over really, really tense and sort of show their belly to kind of say, hey, I don't want any part of this. Or just sort of hunkering down and becoming generally kind of unresponsive are things that you'll see an ostrich do to try to avoid conflict or diffuse conflict, I should say.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think, we'll talk more about nurturing ostriches soon. So I won't get into it. So I think that was a good description. But we definitely see quite a few of those as well. Definitely easier to notice if your dog has that. And I'll hold off on anything until we get into the actually nurturing them section. So,
but I will say, Brian, though, to that point, and I know we will circle back as well. Some of the, if ostriches are being quite obvious about their avoidance behaviors, I agree with you, they're really easy to spot. I would say sometimes similar to peacemakers, people can actually miss these types of behaviors if you're not super familiar with more subtle dog body language and say, oh, they're fine, when actually the dog is working really hard to try to avoid escalation and saying that they're uncomfortable or that they're perceiving conflict. But because they're not, warrioring, which we'll talk about in a second, or Tasmanian deviling, which is also pretty obvious, some of their signals can be missed depending how intense they are.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So cool.
So that's good. So next up, do you want to do warrior or Tasmanian devil next?
Let's do Tasmanian devil. Let's do Tasmanian devil. We'll leave the warrior to the end.
Okay. So Tasmanian devils, if you have one at home, you probably already know. You're probably maybe chuckling right now because it's a term that I think suits them really well. These are those dogs who, when they're presented with any sort of potential perceived conflict, they just ramp up to a level 12 out of 10 on the excitement and over arousal or overstimulated scale. So they just completely like spin up and lose themselves. And it's a stress response. I should, you know, it's, they're typically not comfortable with the situation, but it comes out as a whole lot of energy and excitement. Can look like excited barking. Sometimes they, these dogs spin, tail chasing, zooming around the room. And then this one can be difficult for people sometimes, especially if you have a larger dog, but doing some really sort of persistent, like jumping and mouthing or clawing at what they perceive to be the threat or the source of conflict, or jumping and mouthing at other people in the environment or other dogs in the environment are what is what Tasmanian devils do when they perceive conflict.
Yeah. And we've had a couple of those ourselves as pet dogs.
Absolutely.
Buster, who passed away, and if I put Mo in there as well.
Mosey's absolutely. Yeah. Mo's a bit of a combo, which we'll talk about in a second, but.
Yeah, he is a bit of a combo, but he was Tasmanian Devil level 10 because he would grab clothing and rip it off you. And we were definitely, that was very clear on day one after we adopted him. And we do, yeah, and we do see that frequently. And I do think in our New York City location, I know at other locations as well, where we have a lot of bully breeds, tends to be a conflict resolution style for a lot of them. So, yeah, that's probably resonating with some of you right now, but it's not restricted to just one breed, so or breed type.
Absolutely.
Cool. So should we talk about warriors?
Yeah, last one. Warriors. So I'm really fond of this categorization. I'm not saying I'm fond of this conflict resolution style necessarily, but because I think it takes a... Warriors basically are... They're taking the tactic of trying to dismantle a perceived threat by using threatening displays of their own, right? Mm-hmm. Or aggressive behavior that's designed to really make the other party back off, back away from the conflict. So they may be trying to make someone else ostrich, right? Or at least abandon the conflict. Whereas some of the other styles, like the ostrich or the peacemaker, they're trying to diffuse and bring the temperature down between both parties. And warriors are really saying, I'd like you to back up to make this conflict go away. Some behaviors from, and that doesn't, again, I want to stress, that doesn't mean that these dogs are just picking fights with everyone.
Right.
Right. That is not the case. It's just, they're saying, hey, I perceive a conflict. Perhaps you should back away. Perhaps you should leave. So things like fixed eye contact, forward shifted body weight, sometimes a tail held really high and stiff that can be wagging or still. And then more kind of classic things we would think of, like growling or snapping or charging, muzzle punching or biting. But I just want to stress that those ones further up the ladder of aggression aren't, you can have a warrior who may go through their whole life and never display those behaviors, especially if they're really skilled at some of the lower level interventions. So I think I just want to stress that, but I love having this classification because otherwise these are dogs who might just be labeled, you know, dominant or pushy or just straight up aggressive. And some may absolutely display aggressive behaviors that we need to help them with. You know, we need to navigate conflict differently, but I think it takes a lot of the judgment, sort of the emotional baggage that comes with a dog who may display some of these behaviors. It takes it out of it and sort of legitimizes it as, no, this is just like, this is a strategy to deal with conflict that's valid. And that exists throughout the animal world and exists in the dog world.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's one of the reasons why I sort of feel like the term warrior, because, you know, like a lot of these, you know, people are listening, a lot of these come down to like fight, flight, freeze. And well, for Tasmanian devils, just sort of being, I guess.
Get frantic.
Get frantic. The fourth F.
And fawn for the peacemaker one.
Yeah. And so it sort of lines up to that. But I do find like with warriors, this isn't to downplay, like if there is a dog showing aggressive behaviors, it's not to downplay that, hey, like this is probably something we need to help the dog with. But at the same time, it's also like to really take the perspective of like, they are an animal and they have these different strategies, to deal with conflict. So, and like you said, it doesn't mean that they're bad if they have this warrior conflict resolution style. And it's, and I think for some owners, while again, not downplaying the importance of working through aggressive issues, it's also can help to be like, oh, they're warrioring right now, or I'm putting them in situations that's causing them to be a warrior. So how can I help them with that? So I know for some of the clients that I've been working with, I do feel like this term has sort of helped people understand them a little bit differently, as opposed to just being like, you're a jerk for acting this way.
I agree. And I think because when we hear the term warrior, it automatically communicates that there's a certain context in which that behavior happens. If you're a warrior as a person, you don't just walk around warrioring all the time, right? Like you go to battle or you perceive conflict and you're a warrior at that moment. And sort of the same thing with dogs. So I think it can help people understand that, yes, this is about how they respond in certain contexts where they're perceiving conflict and how do we deal with that in that way. So I agree with you. I think it can take a lot of the, it can make it easier to appreciate it as a strategy versus as something that is, you know, feels a lot more personal sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, so those are our four categories. And I think now that we've discussed them all neatly packaged up, it's always important to remember that nothing in behavior or in life, but nothing in behavior certainly is ever black and white or clear cut. So, really important to call out that while there's lots of dogs who do fit pretty neatly in one category, it's also, there's also lots more who might use like a combination of styles, sometimes a really predictable combination of styles where they go through this pattern of, I try one thing and if that doesn't work, I try another. And that dogs can also use different styles depending on the situation or the type of individual they're interacting with. So whether it's like with familiar people or unfamiliar people or women or men or familiar dogs or small dogs or large dogs. So it can all vary, but there typically is some level of pattern and predictability within certain contexts or situations, which can be really helpful for people to know how to deal with what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely. And also I would just add that for anyone who might have recently got a rescue dog or adopted a dog, those conflict resolution styles for sure can change drastically over the first 30 to 90 days even. So during that period, you really don't know unless you have like really good background information from like a foster or something, you probably really don't know. So I did just also want to throw a caveat in there is like, just because your dog might seem like a peacemaker or an ostrich on day two after adoption, as they sort of settle in and get comfortable, they might have other strategies there. So just to make sure that that's important. But once you have some history of a dog and you've lived with them for a while, like I would agree, like you generally are going to know what is their response going to be.
And typically if it's, I think that's a really important thing to call out. And on that same line of thinking that they can change over time based on a dog's age, right? As they move through like puppyhood into adolescence, adulthood, and then become a senior. But also based on things like health status or stress level,
right?
You know, that, and that's where I would say sometimes you can see like a more sudden change.
Mm-hmm.
And that might be a nice flag for you to say, hey, that's out of character for my dog. What else might be going on to make that happen? The age-based changes sometimes are a little bit more gradual, I find anyway.
Yes. Yeah, that's definitely true. And I would agree with, and also I think too, just realizing like, hey, if my dog is choosing a warrior strategy, even if it's been like that for a while, there's been lots of dogs as well, where when, you know, potential subtle signs of pain or health issues were looked at and addressed, like that sort of went away. So it's sort of like with people, like if you hurt your back, you might be a little bit more grumpy and more likely to snap at people. And I will say, just to add into that for anyone who has a warrior out there, just the longer we do this and the more we work with our vet behaviorists and our vet colleagues, and I think as a team getting more skilled at like, how do we identify stuff? That is one area where that can drastically change how a dog responds to conflict if they're feeling uncomfortable. So, you know, we have other episodes on that, but just wanted to put that out there that it's important to just be like, oh, well, like he's just a warrior. Well, like maybe.
Why is he choosing that strategy?
But why is he choosing that strategy? Right. And I think that's something that is always important. That's always important to keep in mind.
Absolutely. And I think to that point, it's, yes, how they respond to conflict and even how likely they can be to perceive conflict as well. you know, if there's something else going on in the background.
Yes.
They can be a lot more likely to perceive conflict, whereas another dog may not, or where if they were not feeling in pain, or where if they were feeling more comfortable, they wouldn't perceive conflict in certain situations.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you had to pick sort of in a pet dog world, let's talk about for dog to human. I think I know the answer, but like, what do you think is the ideal style for a dog to have?
With humans, I mean, peacemaker.
Yeah. And with other dogs.
With other dogs?
I would say it depends who they're interacting with.
It really depends, because they're sometimes just avoiding, like ostriches, like mm-hmm. if they sense conflict and they just avoid, like they can diffuse a lot of things and get themselves out of situations. I feel like peacemakers take on a little too much responsibility sometimes. And not everyone's into the peacemaking.
I would agree with that. I think there are times with certain maybe warriors or even ostriches or Tasmanian devils who they're just like, I don't care, dude, how much you want to be friends. I don't want to be friends right now.
Exactly.
So I would say that with dogs, and it's interesting that I agree there's a difference between the two. I think with people, and it's probably because we expect some level of just go with the flow, you know, as long as the person's good intention, let's help you follow the guidance of the person in front of you. But with other dogs where it's a little bit more, I guess, peer to peer, they would say, I think probably some of the most skilled dogs that I've ever seen work, to your point, I know you mentioned they have a lot of peacemaker characteristics, but wow, they can like switch so fluidly between, I'm going to try to be your friend. Oh, that's too much. I'm going to avoid and do a little bit of ostriching. Yeah. You're coming on too strong. Hey, I'm going to set a boundary and warrior you a little bit to back you off. And then I'm going to go right back into peacemaker behaviors again. Like they just flow in and out of the different styles.
Yeah.
It's really cool to see them sort of set boundaries and then diffuse and then make social overtures. So I would say with other dogs, a combo style, I don't know that they necessarily need the Tasmanian devil characteristic in there.
Probably not.
But the other three, I think having a combination of them is probably most advantageous.
Yeah, it probably is. Cause also like you have to be careful. Like they can set boundaries as well. Like, so like you said, like sort of that they're not afraid. Like I feel like those peacemakers that aren't necessarily afraid of conflict, like they can really, I feel like other dogs perceive them as like confident, but like not threatening. Mm-hmm. But also like you can't push them around either. Right. So I would agree with that. So yeah, the combo thing. But when I was thinking like peacemaker ostrich, but I never thought about sort of that warrior side, but sort of a very calm, subtle warrior where it's more like they're presenting like I can go there.
Well, and it's even just I need space.
Yes.
I'm not gonna yield my space right now. I need you to give me some space. Yeah. So that we can continue this interaction in a really friendly way.
Yes.
You know, and I know we mentioned Buster briefly, but one of our first helper dogs, I loved how he did this. You know, he would go in and flip back and forth between let's play, I'm your friend. Hey, hold up.
Yep.
Back off a little bit. Hey, let's play, and immediately invite back in for play. And he switched back and forth between those two really well.
Yeah.
But again, that was sort of those lower level warrior characteristics, I guess we could call them.
Yeah.
But they're still asking someone to yield space.
Yes.
And then I guess we could say with people, when I ask that question, I guess it's, that's related specifically to social relationships within a family, but typically with strangers too. I mean, we don't want for pet dogs, we could have a different conversation potentially about working dogs and certain types of guardian breeds and things like that.
Yeah.
But for the most part, we would want dogs as family pets to choose peacemaker as a style.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or to default to peacemaker as a style.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that's true. Because I think just talking with, like once you're into like dog socialization, like you're in a whole other world and like our influence is, you know, we can manage the environment, we can get feedback and do different things, but they are in their own communication system. But yeah, I would agree. Like with dogs and people, we're probably mostly just looking for peacemaker stuff, and then also training the owner to make sure that we're watching our dogs and their interactions with people to know, like, when we have to step in and remove them from situations that people aren't respecting boundaries or being inappropriate with them, because unfortunately that does happen quite a bit, even if people have the best intent. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
Good. Anything else to add about the styles themselves, maybe before we get into things to be mindful of when it comes to living with dogs with different conflict resolution styles?
I don't think so. I think that's a good overview. And then we can talk about nurturing them and living with them.
Yes, absolutely.
Cool.
And so I think this really gets into, you know, at the end of the day, are there really differences in how we respond and try to be, you know, safe, predictable, helpful leaders to our dogs? Is how we respond really going to vary based on how they approach, how they typically approach conflict? And I didn't spend too much time preparing specific talking points or anything like that for this, because I thought it would just be interesting to have the discussion and say, what really would we do differently? You know, we make recommendations to clients all the time. But yeah, say what would you do differently at home if you were having, you know, if you have a peacemaker versus if you have a warrior, or if you have like a Tasmanian devil. So maybe starting off with peacemakers, and we previewed this a little bit earlier. What are some things to keep in mind if you have a peacemaker at home when it comes to navigating conflict?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think the biggest thing with peacemakers, and I think we touched on this a bit, is like, it's really easy to overlook how they're feeling because they're quote unquote fine. And definitely would always challenge people. Like, if you're saying like, my dog's fine, then it might require a little bit more examination. So I feel like with peacemakers, like for example, like you'll have like dogs who have a peacemaker and they can go into rowdy dog parks all the time and not get into conflict, but they could be there just like, you know, peacemaking the whole time because that's what they need to do to sort of cope. But like, would they actually choose to be in there to begin with? Or are we going too much? And there's ways to sort of look at that. Like, are they excited to go into the dog run? Or are they just sort of, it's just sort of part of the routine? Like, do they have other outlets to play in situations where you don't see them having to do that much peacemaking? So maybe it's like one-on-one play where they're like actually engaging in a lot of play and seem a lot more comfortable. So like reading that body language is important. But I feel like everyone just assumes that they're fine. But I have seen peacemakers where I think they were put in situations way too often that they weren't comfortable with. Yep. And because it wasn't resulting in aggression or any outright fear that's very obvious to people, it just gets overlooked. And I know I've seen peacemakers in the past where they were peacemakers for quite some time and then they changed that.
They gave up. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would agree with that. And I think part of that, though, truthfully, can be if you have a peacemaker, well, it may not seem as necessary to know from the perspective of your own dog, actually taking time to learn, like, what are the signals and cues of Tasmanian devils and warriors and ostriches, because you almost have to read the other party, right? Like if your dog is interacting and they're interacting in a way that's like, hey, I'm playful, let's be friends. Are they doing that because the other dog's doing the same thing? Or are they doing that because the other dog is standing over them with a stiff body and a tail wagging? You're like, hey, that's a conflict that my dog is having to resolve. If they're doing that all the time, they probably let's need a break. Let's find another playmate. So I think learning to actually observe the other dog in the interaction as well can be nice insight for people to say, hey, is this a conflict that my peacemaker is resolving, or are they just having fun?
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So kind of looking at both members of that interaction, I think is important. And then I think because of that, like you already mentioned, just offering them an out. Like if you see them peacemaking up a storm in the dog park because there's some dogs there, or wherever you may be taking them, or at a social interaction because maybe there's people who are behaving a little inappropriately and like leaning and grabbing their face or doing things that are just kind of stressful for the dog, give your dog an out. Hey buddy, let's take a break, and call them away and tell them they're a wonderful dog for choosing the strategies that they are, because it's amazing. But don't take for granted that will persist forever, because at a certain point, if they feel like they're not being listened to, to your point, they may try other strategies, and we can't blame them for that.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, but I sort of feel like that's the biggest thing with peacemakers is like, I sort of feel like sometimes like they're like screaming for help, but no one's hearing them.
Yeah. And I think sometimes if we look at more subtle, like we can see some stress pants or we can see some little signs of ostriching in there where they're doing like flicking away and avoiding and then coming back to peacemaking again.
Yeah.
Or Tasmanian devil, and they're like ramping up and arousal level while trying to play. Like looking for those signs can be helpful.
Yeah, definitely. And I also think it comes back to too, like it's something where I think with all these styles or in general reading, like it's, we also have to be really careful of like labeling activities as good or bad just based on like what activity they are. It's like, oh, yes, they're getting to socialize with other dogs, so that's a good thing. Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe it's not really good.
Yeah.
And I think like this all comes back to, again, like does your dog think that this is fun?
Right.
And just because,
today, did they think today, it's fun today?
Or even like in this 5 minutes, because like you can be in a dog park and they're having a great time and then a bruiser comes in. Mm-hmm. And throws off the whole thing, and it gets a lot of the dogs sort of amped up and they're all feeling nervous, and then they have to go into peacemaker mode. So you might just have to leave. And we are going to do a whole episode on dog parks and talking about that. But I think that whole thing is really challenging yourself to not be in the mindset that activities are good or bad. It's like, actually, is my dog enjoying this? Yes or no?
Absolutely.
And that can change in the moment. So, And I do feel like clients who have learned how to do that, like definitely make a lot more progress because they're just able to hear their dog basically.
Yeah.
You know,
I would agree with that.
Yeah.
So what about ostriches?
So yeah.
What are some things for people to keep in mind if they live with an ostrich?
I sort of feel like with ostriches, it kind of falls into two things for me. Like I feel like on one side of things, sometimes those dogs can just kind of the same thing people like, oh, like they're a little nervous and fine, and they get put into a lot of situations. Mm-hmm. So they're kind of just, I guess, you know, steamrolled into a lot of things. But also I feel like there are also people that when they notice that their dog is an ostrich and sort of struggling with that, and especially if it's coming out in a lot more signs of like fear, and avoidance, I feel like sometimes people can get paralyzed on like how to move forward with those behaviors, because like everyone says, like, well, just do socialization or just make, you know, help them feel more comfortable. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, how do I do that? You know, when I'm in the middle of a walk or I'm in like these play groups or different things. So it's like those are sort of like the two things that I sort of see sort of like on two ends of the spectrum. So one is it sort of just kind of gets ignored and because the dog's not being aggressive, so it's okay. Or on the other side, it's like people almost get paralyzed with like, what do I do to move forward? Or maybe they don't give them opportunities to do certain things because maybe they're choosing this tactic and maybe that's a little too far as well. So I feel like there's a lot of nuance I find with ostriches. Mm-hmm. Like, is it purely just like a conflict resolution style that they're choosing to navigate a situation, or is it like a more general response to everything? And so I feel like with ostriches, I feel like the spectrum is really wide, at least for me. And I have to do a lot more time understanding sort of like what's causing them to act in these ways or to choose this conflict resolution style to sort of move forward. So I know that was a little bit of a mouthful, but I always find when I get dogs that are ostriches, like I feel like there's a lot of digging that we have to do to sort of figure out like, A, like, is it appropriate? Because sometimes being an ostrich and doing it is totally appropriate and there's nothing we have to do. It's like, mm-hmm. That's fine. They're just choosing it. And then there's other times where I feel like it's sort of a symptom of like a global thing with them, you know?
Right. Is it really a conflict resolution strategy? And if it is, are they perceiving conflict every minute of the day? And that just, they're just, to your point, like globally fearful or anxious or worried.
Yep.
Right. Or is it just a strategy that happens?
Yes.
At times we would expect, but that's the strategy they're choosing. I would say with ostriches too, like sometimes these dogs, if it really is just, it's a response to perceived conflict. Sometimes these are the dogs who can unfortunately get labeled as like, see, he knows he did the wrong thing.
Right.
Or see, she's guilty.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're choosing because the behaviors that they're displaying are ones that to us look like they feel bad. They maybe feel guilty. And so sometimes these dogs can, you know, get in a little bit more trouble depending on the human's conflict resolution style. So I think being mindful of that ostriches choose behaviors that may look to us like guilt or feeling bad about something. And I'm not even saying that there's some world where dogs potentially can't feel guilt. I'm just saying as a conflict resolution strategy, we can perceive it as them being like guilty or knowing they did the wrong thing when they're just trying to diffuse conflict and diffuse tension. So I think keeping that in mind. And then, yeah, to that point as well, I agree with you wholeheartedly about these dogs can also get put into that they're fine category and eventually abandon that strategy and try, you know, warrioring or whatever else. I think the other one sometimes too is that, I want to be careful about this, but sometimes it's almost as though we see those types of behaviors and we just get stuck in this mindset of like, oh, he feels so bad. And we sort of get stuck there instead of saying, how do I help? Like, you're okay, buddy, let's do it. And I don't mean putting your dog in any situation and thinking you can just cheerlead them through it. But for lower level conflicts, having this belief that they're not broken, right? Like they're capable, they're okay. I can help you. Like, I'm going to reward forward movements. I'm going to reward a loose body. I'm going to reward maybe a little like look up at me to see, nice job, buddy. That's it. You're fine. You know, like really taking that approach versus necessarily just feeling bad for those behaviors that look pretty sad.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that's what I was sort of getting at is like where people sort of feel paralyzed. I feel like sometimes with that is like they get stuck in that, like this is one, and you always have to be careful because it's not just all about how you act or any of those things. But I do find for ostriches who are like your body language and how you communicate things to them when they're in these situations for these dogs, I think matters a lot for some of them. Now, some of them, I don't think it really mattered, but there's definitely some dogs where like their connection with their owner and how like that social referencing or whatever that they're using to sort of assess a situation, we can really make things go one of two ways with these dogs. And I think that's where it's always talking through that. And I always get frustrated with, you know, like different dog advice that it's all about how you act or you just have to act confident or just like, so I'm not going there. But at the same time, if you're also acting hesitant and nervous and fearful.
Yes.
And if your dog is doing any sort of social referencing about like what's going on or how should I perceive the situation, then yeah, like it can make it hard to move forward.
It can.
And I know because people just feel bad for them. Like I understand where that comes from, but it's sort of that like, well, all right, we're ready to move forward. So I'm not going to put them in situations that are going to overwhelm them. But also if there's situations where we think that they can cope or it's a little bit more fair for them to put them in situations where they're maybe able to cope better, but like we're making sure we're paying attention to what we're communicating to them through our body language and things matters.
Yeah.
So I would agree with that for sure.
Yeah. So I think if you have an ostrich, just being mindful of like nice, confident, a lot of these dogs do well with kind of jolly talk. And again, I'm not talking about when they're incredibly panicked and fearful, just in general, those sort of ostrich type responses, a lot of like, we're good, no worries. And being mindful of body language and avoiding things like leaning over or anything that they could perceive as, you know, further escalating the conflict that they would perceive as potentially threatening is really important to avoid. Mm-hmm. And yeah, rewarding and encouraging those peacemaker style behaviors that they might throw out sometimes mixed in with some of the ostriching that they do.
Yeah.
I feel like can go a long, long way in them learning like maybe there's other ways I can deal with this.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So anything else about ostriches?
No, I think that's good. I feel like if you have an ostrich and if you feel like you're struggling a bit, you might need someone to help walk you through that. I find that one a little bit more complicated for people. Not always, but I would say that's the only other thing.
It's
I find ostriches very nuanced.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. Understandable. And I would argue that really the next three that were these and the next two that we're going to talk about, you may benefit from someone helping you through in different ways. But
yeah.
Should we do Tasmanian Devils next and save warriors for the end?
Yeah.
Okay. So what do would you like to start, or would you like me to start with thoughts about Tasmanian devils?
Well, you were closer to Buster and Mo, because I was more with our rat terriers. As we have four dogs now. We did have five, but like I felt like you worked with Buster and Mo more than I did. So why don't you start off with,
in terms of really living with Tasmanian devils?
Yes, I mean, I've helped lots of people with Tasmanian devils, but in terms of living with them,
sure. Yeah. I think one of the biggest things to be really mindful about if you have a Tasmanian devil is that it's so easy to ramp up with them and to kind of match their energy and intensity as you're trying to calm them down.
Hey,
right? And your movements get bigger and your voice gets louder, and you're just, because you're trying to shut that energy down. But a lot of times you're just adding to it. You're adding more. If we think about this as conflict resolution, we're escalating the conflict along with them. So even though it's really easy to do that, for a variety of reasons, it generally only makes things worse. So I feel like with Tasmanian devils, it's so important to have your movements and your voice and everything about what you're doing be purposeful and calm, even if you're not feeling that way inside, even if you're feeling kind of agitated or scared, you know, depending how big your dog is and the types of behaviors that they're showing. And really doing a lot of work to redirect Tasmanian devils to calmer activities and behaviors. So this means like doing some prep work where maybe you do a ton of work on a default super relaxed down or relax on a mat so that you can help them bring that excitement and arousal level down with a behavior that they know and love and are super comfortable with. And sometimes I think with Tasmanian devils too, is depending on the size, especially if you have a bigger dog who's a Tasmanian devil, you know, you're going to have to sometimes, especially early on, rely on some management or equipment, things like gates or a drag line, like a leash, so that you can maybe lead them behind a gate and give yourself some physical distance, especially if they display behaviors like jumping up at you or mouthing or clawing, so that you don't have to escalate yourself. You can just do kind of a physical barrier to say, hey, you don't have access to me right now. I'm going to help you calm down.
Yeah.
They certainly need that calm, confident guidance. And it's so hard sometimes putting yourself in that mindset of like, I'm going to help you bring your feet back to the ground.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And because I think these are also dogs who fall in the category of it's really easy for folks to want to reach for things like more kind of aversive equipment to like shut down the behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times, sometimes it can inhibit it quickly, but then I feel like it almost, it's coming out.
It's coming out elsewhere.
Right? If we don't teach them how to actually kind of calm down and regulate themselves a little bit better, it's coming out somewhere else, or they can bottle it up for a little while, but then it just comes back the same or maybe worse, who knows. But I think that's something to keep in mind as well, is it's so easy to want to reach for like, how do I control this behavior and shut it down? Versus how do I help them bring down their physiological arousal level in a way that's more positive and pleasant.
Definitely. I mean, these dogs are like totally misunderstood.
Yeah.
Like I feel like most people have a completely wrong take on these dogs, like professionals and owners, to be honest. Like it's, there's no judgment there. Cause it looks like a certain thing, but like, and to be clear, I thought the same thing years ago as well. And I think it sort of got to a point where it's just like, I see those dogs and it's like, ooh, you're struggling.
Yeah.
You know, like you're really struggling and you need help just to feel better and how to deal with these emotions. And you're sort of overwhelmed, by a lot of things. And it's definitely, and this one for sure, this is one where your body language and everything is going to matter. And that is where like having like the right equipment and guidance on how to help them settle without making them more stressed is like sort of a fine line to walk sometimes.
Absolutely. Because also these dogs can be really tricky because if they're perceiving conflict, but their physiological arousal is really high, sometimes things like toss treats on the ground for them or use high value food to get them into a sit. Like, because their excitement level, when I say arousal level, I just mean like physiological sort of excitement level is so high. Sometimes depending how we use food can make things worse. So yeah, knowing how to navigate that and say that doesn't mean that they're not well suited to positive training.
Right.
It just means that we have to, maybe we use a different reinforcer altogether, or maybe we use a different type of food, or maybe we use food differently. Mm-hmm. But I think that's one of the things that can sometimes lead people to believe, oh no, but my dog needs punishment because the food made it worse.
Yes. Yeah.
And, no, and I believe you, it probably did. Yep. That just means we have to adjust what we're doing.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And you're right. Like, it's like even how we're using the food and how are we using our body language with the food and what environments are we actually exposing them to? Like when they're working through this, because the other thing with these dogs too, is like, yeah, like you definitely, you know, the challenge with these dogs is these behaviors a lot of times are pretty urgent because it can make it really hard to walk them, especially mm-hmm. people getting like their shirts ripped off them or, you know, a lot of times like the mouthing can cause bruising or even holes, and it's not a bite like, you know, they're intending to cause harm. They're kind of getting over aroused, but like the outcome's the same, mm-hmm. right? So, yeah. It's something we have to deal with. So like it's something where you have to make progress, you know, at a reasonable pace, but then also picking, okay, like really diving into like what situations are causing this and mm-hmm. like really getting into like, how do we navigate those situations, or are there different ways we can manage the environment or design the environment to sort of help us, you know, kind of take those steps to get where we want to get to. But yeah, I honestly, because I think a lot of times too, these behaviors can be seen as funny.
Sometimes.
Like they are, because it's sort of like, especially with the spinning mm-hmm. and if it's like in a dog park setting and stuff, but like for me,
it's funny until it's not.
Yeah. Funny until it's not. And yeah. I know for me, like I almost find it painful to look at this point mm-hmm. in my career. Cause it's just sort of like, again, I like dogs having fun and running around and playing and jumping and all those things, but that's not what this is. The good news on this though, is there's usually lots you can do to make it better. So I think the good mm-hmm. thing with the Tasmanian Devil is like, there are many roots in terms of environmental design, behavior modification, even working with a vet or a vet behaviorist and behavior medication to help with those arousal levels. So like there's lots of different paths out there. And I have a soft spot for them because we've had a couple, and I think misinterpreted it for, you know, way back in early in our mm-hmm. career as well, you know?
Absolutely. So, yeah. I would agree with that. Perfect. Should we move on to our last one?
Yeah. Warriors.
Mm-hmm. Would you like to start this time?
Yeah.
Things to keep in mind.
Yeah. Well, I think the first thing is just, I feel like when we have clients who have warriors, I feel like the first thing to keep in mind is that you have a warrior. I know that doesn't sound too insightful, but it's sort of knowing that like, hey, if push comes to shove, like they will go into that mode. And I think it's something where, that's not to like, that doesn't mean like you can't change things, make things a lot better, but sort of just recognizing that like that this is their conflict resolution strategy that they can choose. So you have to be very good at reading your dog's body language and reading the situations to hopefully prevent them from, you know, from going there. So I would say like that being mindful of body language is really important. And then also like you have to be very good at sort of de-escalation skills
yes.
as well, because I feel like it can feel intuitive, especially if you have a dog who's directing stuff towards you as an owner. Like that can be an extremely frustrating behavior to go through. We do have an episode lined up for that as well. And I think for some people, and I guess we'll talk about mismatches, but other people who tend to be on the more warrior side of things as well, it's easy to like raise conflict. So absolutely. Like it can be really challenging because one, it sort of hits personally when your dog is like maybe showing aggression towards you, or like another dog in your household or whatever it is. So it can be sort of emotionally charged, and having people sort of remain grounded to sort of think through. And that's why I think it's important to have a game plan for these dogs as well, that, hey, if they're starting to go into this mode, or I expect that, like, what is the game plan? So I think for me, it's like recognizing that, that you have that doesn't mean like you should be walking around on eggshells. And if that, that's the case, then there's, you know, something else wrong. But at the same time, like, making sure you're good at reading body language and de-escalating, I think for me are sort of like two of the big things.
Absolutely. I agree. And I think that point about de-escalating conflict, and that doesn't mean appeasing.
No.
Which maybe we can talk about that in the mismatch section.
But, yeah.
But I would agree with you. And I think because if you have shared your home with an ostrich or a peacemaker, maybe with the Tasmanian devil, but certainly with those other two, if your tactic to resolve conflict has been typically to sort of warrior and escalate it and get your dog to yield and back off, that strategy is going to be harder with a warrior and really unpleasant. And I'm not saying it's a good one to choose with the other two either, but you can get away with it.
You can get away with it.
Right?
Yeah.
So with warriors, it's going to come, it's going to look different.
Yeah.
If you go that path, it's going to be unpleasant for both of you.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think recognizing that, to your point, and saying, how do I de-escalate in a way that is calm and confident and friendly and purposeful and still leaves you in a position where you're a trusted guide and a leader? You're not just, to your point, walking on eggshells, tiptoeing around saying, oh goodness, I'm sorry that I offended you somehow.
Yeah.
Is really important. And maybe to operationalize that a little bit. I think a lot of what that looks like, if you're having like, hey, I see my dog is starting to perceive conflict and they're a warrior, you know, inviting them out of that space where the conflict is happening and giving them direction of like doing another activity or moving on to something else. And I know we don't want to get too specific because there's a million different situations and contexts that can happen. But I think I just want to drive home the point that it's still really important to be in kind of a parental, like, leadership position with these guys or these girls, in a way that's actually helpful, right? Like, that's like helpful and safe and predictable and doesn't escalate things.
Yeah.
Cause just appeasing them can be a little dangerous and have unwanted outcomes.
Yeah.
If it happens over and over again versus in one just acute situation.
Yeah. I mean, 100%. And I feel like that's also, I think sometimes on like the positive reinforcement side of things, I feel like sometimes we can make it appear that a lot of the stuff we're doing is appeasing.
Right.
And it's there's a lot of trainers out there. That's mostly what they're doing too. But there's lots of, you know, positive reinforcement based trainers where that's not the case. It's not just about appeasing, and you need that parachute cord. If like a really bad situation comes up and you have to get out of it, like, that's fine. But also, like, how do we actually move forward and establish like a relationship that's healthy, like moving forward and honestly just helping them feel like I don't have to go into this mode that
Absolutely.
Often. Like, I feel like for a lot of these dogs, it's just like they got confused somewhere along the way, or it's a strategy that worked for them. And then we just have to like teach them like, hey, like, you don't really need to be this stressed about this particular thing. So I sort of feel like, yeah. Yeah.
And even if there's not stress, just letting them know that there's other options. There's other ways to deal with this Absolutely. That are as effective.
Yes.
Or more effective, depending.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. So should we wrap things up and talk a little bit about mismatches?
I think so.
Between humans and dogs, or dogs and dogs. And I think these align pretty closely, whether it's dog-dog or human-dog.
Yeah.
So I think we touched on them a little bit in the warrior section, but are there certain types of conflict resolution styles that you feel like just go really well together? And are there other ones that you just feel like are a very poor fit? So who goes well together? Peacemakers and pretty much anyone?
I would say peacemakers and pretty much anyone.
I mean, not necessarily for the peacemaker.
Yeah.
But your lowest risk option is peacemaker.
Yes.
And then I would say probably peacemaker ostrich.
Absolutely.
And then peacemaker, I'd be touch and go on the warrior or the Tasmanian devil. I think I'd probably put them in close to the same category. Maybe warrior and then Tasmanian devil. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not sure why. I feel like sometimes peacemakers bring some energy to the Tasmanian devils that's not particularly helpful.
I would agree with that for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then it kind of like gets stuck in this like loop.
Yes.
Like this feedback loop that like, you know, where like you're getting, your mic gets this echo and it's like,
there's someone play bowing and someone spinning and it just keeps happening just over keeps and over again.
Yeah. It just keeps happening over and over again. So, I do find that. I find Tasmanian devils in general a little tricky.
I think because the way it's almost like this, to me, that's more wholly indicative of a stress response or like an I'm uncomfortable response versus, and I don't know what to do versus with the other ones. Sometimes truthfully, the dog may not be terribly uncomfortable at all.
Yeah.
They're just like, hey, there's a conflict. I'm going to resolve it this way. Sometimes they are very uncomfortable, but I feel like it's not necessarily the case. It's just like a social strategy. And I feel like with the Tasmanian devils, like they just don't know. Right. It's kind of like an, I don't know what to do. So I'm spinning up.
Yeah.
And that's my own interpretation. I don't know if that's really the case, but I feel like that's why, to your point, like that's a trickier one.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And then I do find too, like even that, like the warrior ostrich combination.
You're like, that's a terrible fit.
Yeah. Like that's where I was going.
Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah. So we've talked about who's good together.
Yeah.
So if we get into bad fits.
Yeah. Bad fits. Definitely that warrior ostrich combination. I feel like you think it might be okay, but
it's okay for like one interaction. It's okay for acute sort of pass by interactions most of the time.
Yeah.
Right. Where you're just like, you encounter someone who's maybe scary or threatening. And I'm not saying that warriors are scary or threatening, but if you encounter a situation where someone's maybe like being more forward, just appeasing and ostriching and getting out of it and moving on can be really effective. But I feel like if that's an ongoing pattern in a relationship,
yeah,
it's really not great.
Yeah, absolutely. And it can lead to like, I feel like with certain dogs, so not all warriors are bullies either, but there are some, I feel like sometimes too with that, with the repeated exposure to that, like it is one dog just kind of getting bullied and steamrolled a lot.
Yeah. Well, it's reinforcing to win a conflict, yeah. Right? So I think it's like, If you have a warrior living with an ostrich, both of those behaviors can kind of get more and more and more amplified over time.
Mm-hmm. And honestly, like there have been families where they kind of have this warrior ostrich, like these two dogs, and they've had them and managed them for a while. And you know, things got better, but it was still stressful, I think, for the ostrich. But like if like the warrior passed away, or that was rehomed, like that ostrich like totally came out of their shell. And I've seen that numerous times.
Yeah.
Like I think like, cause it's basically it's like a stressful, it can be a really stressful environment to live in. Again, because it's not causing big fights or those types of things, it can get overlooked, but they're not like, they're struggling. A lot of those dogs, like living with that other dog. So
I think so too. And yeah. I think that comes back to, again, it's beyond the scope of today's conversation to say, how do you manage that? But I think it's being aware that if you have that dynamic in your household, even if there's not fights happening, that doesn't mean it's not a stressful situation. And maybe getting a little bit of guidance on how to manage those dynamics in a way that's really healthy for both dogs can be really helpful.
Yeah.
Yeah. Two warriors together. You just see the sort of like the fireworks going off is typically going to be problematic when there's conflict. And I think that's because like, again, these I think can sometimes be dogs who are like, they're best friends. They love each other. They play all the time. They sleep on the couch and then they just get in these fights.
Yes.
Like once every 2 months because there was a piece of a bone under the couch or something. And I'm not saying that that always means you have two warriors. I know there can be a whole lot else going on there, but, but the reality is, if you have two warriors versus a dog who maybe starts out as a warrior and then turns into an ostrich, if really push comes to shove, when conflict happens, which it will, sometimes that can be tricky.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean that, again, these dogs are sending each other to, like, warriors happen and there's degrees of responses.
Yeah. Yeah, there is. And I'll also say too, with like having two warriors, I do sort of feel like the other risk area for that is actually not with each other. It's like outwards. So like if you're at a dog park and there's something that goes down and one of them gets into a scuffle and starts warrioring, you can kind of get that whole backup piece. Not all the time, but I like, especially, I mean, I'm always nervous with to be perfectly honest, like I we've taken both of our back when we had Buster and Sammy, like take them both to a dog park. I know people take both their dogs to dog parks and stuff. I'm always a little scared when you have like the two family members obviously like going into dog runs, just because when that happens. But I think especially if you have two dogs that can sort of go into that mode, even if it's not happening like frequently or at all, just having both. So I think it's something where you just kind of have to watch and make sure, like if you have dogs who go into that mode with each other, then you might have to be more selective about where you're taking them or where it's appropriate to take them. But that's the thing with the two warriors, is sometimes I find they combine like a Power Ranger.
Yes.
A little bit.
Well said. Well, yeah. Point well taken. And two warriors, I think that everything we just said kind of holds true with the human dog dynamic as well. You know, just be a really tricky situation. Two Tasmanian devils, human or dog. That's a lot.
It's a lot. Two dogs is a lot anyways. I think if anyone on your side, two dogs, we have four, and two dogs is a lot, but two dogs that are Tasmanian deviling, it's a lot.
Yes. And it may be that no one gets hurt.
Yeah.
But there's generally probably going to be some
broken furniture,
broken furniture. And again, they may not be feeling as comfortable as they could be about certain situations. I think one of the real wild cards for me is the Tasmanian devil warrior dynamic, because sometimes weirdly this can work like really well. It's almost like they just throw the warrior off their game. Like they're just like, the warrior's like, I don't know what's happening, but okay. Like, I think you backed up.
Yeah. Well, 100%. Cause sometimes you'll see it like, they're just sort of like, what the hell? Like they're almost like sort of like, they're just sort of like what the.
It cuts the tension for sure. Yeah. Like not always. Sometimes it's an awful combination and it immediately just results in explosions or fireworks. But sometimes it works really well. Like, and I'm thinking about personal experience too, but like our dog Jackie, he has warrior in him.
Oh yeah.
And the dogs he has loved, like the dogs that are beloved to him, our Moses in our house, who's total Tasmanian devil, and Buster, who was like more of a Tasmanian devil. And they just brought the energy and the fun. They were kind of like Tasmanian devil peacemaker combos. So maybe that helped, but that level of energy, just like, I don't know, it worked. And sometimes it's awful, but I think that's just a funny one that it can go either way.
Yeah. Well, I feel like some of those warriors are kind of like, oh, Like, is anyone else seeing this?
It's like this, like, I don't know, you're at some carnival and there's like a, you know, this explosion of like neat lights and sounds that go off and you're sort of disoriented, but then you just go with it and start.
You just roll with it. Yeah.
Exactly.
I'm at the fair, so I might as well go with it.
May as well have fun and go get a turkey leg.
Yeah. So, yeah, no, I mean, that's definitely true. But yeah, it can also, like, and I find like, you'll know pretty quickly because they go into that mode and it triggers something, or you generally will see the reaction from the other dog. Like, oh, and like, I find with some of those warriors sometimes too, like with the Taz, like they'll actually shift their weight backwards
absolutely
a little bit. And sorry, I shift away from my microphone, but they will shift their weight backwards and kind of like, which you don't see all the time with them. But like, it must come off as, I don't know if it's coming off as like non-threatening or just like you said, like they're just sort of blindsided by the ridiculousness of it and don't really know how to process it and then get caught up in the fun.
Yeah, I know. It's quite silly to see when it happens. If you know the two dogs and you sort of know that that's their dynamic. So that, I thought that was just one that was kind of fun to mention. Cool. Did we miss anyone? I don't think so. I don't know what to say about two ostriches, honestly. I feel like if you had two human ostriches, that's like a tough relationship because no conflicts ever really get resolved. I don't know how that plays out.
They both sleep in their own room and don't talk to each other.
Like, relationship just kind of slowly disintegrates.
One person moves to the garage.
I don't really know how that translates truthfully to a dog-human dynamic. I haven't thought it through. So if anyone listens to this episode and has thoughts about it, I would love to hear it.
I sort of feel like, though,
may leave a void in leadership, I guess, but
I sort of feel like I feel like it's sort of in the dog, like it's hard to see two ostriches at once. I sort of feel like someone reads that situation and like will adapt. Like I sort of feel like it's like, especially if they're living together. Cause like there's a lot, that's a much more complicated relationship. Like if there's a bone on the ground, I don't think like both are just going to run to the other end of the room. You know what I mean? Like someone's going to take the bone. I think it's just sort of like who's more of the ostrich or who's less
at that moment.
Yeah. And, you know, but at the same time, like they're probably not getting into conflict a lot. So like, I think they can still like each other as well and still have a good relationship. It's just when conflict arises, there probably won't be anything going down. But I'm trying to think back like to some of like, I feel like seeing two true ostriches, like I don't know how often I've seen that. Like, I feel like if I've seen it,
I think I have.
Yeah. Like I've seen it more like with them in context around like other dogs or other things. But then when I got to know, to see them in their home, they weren't really acting that way with each other. I feel like.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Your experience might be different, but I don't know.
No, I would, if anyone out there thinks they own two ostriches who are ostriching with each other, I would love to see video of it.
Absolutely.
If it's safe to do so.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yes. It's safe to do. So.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think we got them all.
Got them all.
Yep.
Cool. Well, that's it.
That's it.
All right.
So I hope today was interesting. We love this topic and, you know, hopefully it was a little bit thought provoking and helpful. And I think that's all we have to say about it.
Yeah. Sounds good. All right. We'll see you next week. Bye.